I'm Jill Anderson. This is the Harvard EdCast. When talking to Dr. Stanley Andreis, it's hard to fathom that he was once convicted of three felonies and spent time in jail for drug trafficking. A prosecutor actually once said that Dr. Andreis had no hope for change. And yet today, he's an assistant professor at Johns Hopkins University and Howard University training future doctors. He credits education as transforming his life. With 2.2 million people in the U.S. incarcerated, he knows education can also change their lives too, but only if we're willing to give them a second chance. As the director of From Prison Cell to PhD, Dr. Andreis is planting the seeds for change with efforts to help reduce barriers to higher education for formerly incarcerated people. I caught up with Dr. Andreis to hear more about his story and how education needs to change. I'm wondering what made you step back and start From Prison Cells to PhD?
You know, the motivation behind it is essentially myself and the co-founders' stories. I grew up in the Ferguson, Missouri area, and I got involved with the system at a very young age. I started selling drugs at a very young age. I was arrested for the first time at 15 years old. I continued to make poor decisions up until in my early 20s. I was sitting in front of a judge facing 20 years to life. In that process, there was this prosecutor who painted the picture of me as this dangerous threat to society and that I needed to be thrown away. Right. You know, she painted this Picasso picture and laid out all of the terrible things that I had done. And by that time, I had acquired and amassed three felony convictions. So she was successful in sentencing me as this career criminal in my early 20s. Mm-hmm. You know, I internalized this idea of me being this criminal. And now I know that, you know, the brain isn't even fully developed until the mid-20s. This prosecutor was prophesizing that I was going to be this career criminal that had no hope for changing. And that I need to be thrown away for life. But I'm now an endocrinologist scientist and professor at Johns Hopkins Medicine and Howard University College of Medicine, the Mecca. This psychological piece that she bestowed on me is interesting in that I now work in the College of Medicine, where we're training future doctors and physicians and scientists. And it's not until another 16 years or so before we consider these folks that I'm working with to be career professionals. Yet this prosecutor mm-hmm. prophesied that I was a career criminal in my early 20s. And that's damaging. That is very damaging, and the system does it all the time. And for me to reverse that damage, I was fortunate enough to have this mentor step into my life who started investing in my potential, who started investing in this idea that I was not this criminal. It took a long time, as well as some issues personally, before I started feeling that same way. And eventually, when it was time for me to be released, I was of this belief that I did have this potential, and I saw this different trajectory that I could possibly pursue. And I applied to a number of programs, and I was rejected from every single one, except for the one where this mentor was on the admissions committee at St. Louis University. So St. Louis University offered me this second chance. This mentor offered me this second chance. And then I kind of ran with it from there. I got out and I got into the program. I finished at the top of my class, ended up completing my PhD and my MBA in 4 years, which is a little bit faster than most of my peers. It was this hunger that I had, this thirst for change. And that's kind of the drive behind the program. I got out and, you know, some friends of mine that I was incarcerated with, when they seen me preparing to continue my education when I got out, they thought I was kind of crazy. But then when I got out and I was doing it, you know, that inspired them. And the two other individuals who are the co-founders of the program, they got out after me and they were inspired to use education to change their story. And one of them had done a little over 13 years on three different prison stints. He had gotten out two other times, but never been out for more than about 2 months. And it's now been about 7 years. So he successfully used education as this transformational tool. And we all did. And we started helping others. And then eventually we came upon the idea of we should really make this a real thing. Then, you know, we started connecting with people like Kaya Stern at Harvard and folks in California and programs like Project Rebound and folks in Washington like Chris Beasley and his prison education program and in New Jersey and New NJ Step. So we found all these programs that were like, we thought we were inventing the wheel, but as you know, we soon found out there's really nothing new under the sun. And there was already programs doing this great work. And we just essentially took pieces from those programs and the advice and formed this advisory board and went from there.
So you've mentioned a lot just now, like how much what that prosecutor said stuck with you. And in a weird way, it almost sounds like it was a driving factor for you for change, was it?
In a sense, it was, I guess, but it wasn't at the time. Mm. I was just driven to be a different person than I was before. You know, my father, who I had lost contact with when I went in, you know, he became ill, and over the course of about 2 years and nearly 30 surgeries, eventually fell into a coma and lost his battle with type 2 diabetes. And that was very much this internal turning point for me. But, you know, one of the interesting things that I often get asked is, have I ever contacted that prosecutor again? And I've actually contacted her at every single accomplishment and milestone that I've had since I've been home. I invited her to my PhD defense and graduation and so forth.
Well, I have to ask, what has her response been?
She has not come to any of those events.
Wow.
Yeah.
Well, that tells you a lot about incarceration in America.
Yeah.
One of the things I think is so important about your organization is that your emphasis isn't, even though it's in the title, it's not really about the degree or the letters, right?
Right.
It's more than that. You're saying this has a lot to do with hope. What does that mean?
Yeah, so the organizational name is a metaphor for bringing people from this place of hopelessness and desolate despair, you know, of what incarceration is, to this state of hope and reaching one's full potential. Each individual's full potential is very different. So we're very much seeking to give people hope and providing them support, resources, and tools for them to move themselves to what they see as their full potential.
And so education for you was sort of that hope, right?
Yeah, so for me and many others like myself, education is this transformational tool. It's therapeutic even. The studies show that folks who come out of prison, about 40 to 75% of people who step out of prison end up stepping back into prison within 3 to 5 years,
right,
depending on how you calculate it, mm-hmm, state, federal. For those who step foot on a college campus and don't get any degree, they just attend some college, it drops it down into the teens. If you get an associate's degree, it drops it down to 13%, bachelor's degree down to 5%, master's degree and above, and you've basically eliminated your possibility of going back to prison. Another way of saying this is that education increases public safety for the folks,
yeah,
that want to view it in that manner. And, you know, the numbers are just right in your face. Like, it's very clear that education has this transformational nature for folks who have been involved in the system.
So I think that some people listening might wonder why education was so powerful for you after incarceration, whereas maybe when you were younger, education wasn't necessarily that transformational experience for you. Was it maturity?
I'll give kind of an analogy. So, you know, I'm a father just recently.
Congratulations.
My baby girl, Ashlyn Odette, was born just 7 weeks ago. I'm an endocrinologist and reproductive endocrinologist more specifically. So I know about reproduction and babies and pregnancy and stuff like that. But I really don't know as much as I thought I knew about babies, right? So I have this app where I read about babies and their development. And interestingly, I found I'm reading about my daughter's development, and I come across this interesting thing about, you know, babies are growing every minute, almost every day, right? And there was a piece that said that about at 3 to 4 weeks, she'll start waving her hands in front of her, and the brain actually develops to a point that it makes the connection that her hands are attached to her. So she'll be like, whoa, oh my God, my hands are attached to me. So she's like super amazed, and it's this really cute thing. I love watching her do it. But it brings me to this idea, the brain is not developed for her to know that her limbs are attached. And it's very similar in adolescence. The brain is not fully developed yet until you're about 25. And the part of the brain that is not developed is this decision-making aspect. So it's literally as if adolescents in their decision-making, that they literally can't see their arms and their limbs as they're making these decisions. We need to take a serious look at incarcerating kids, youths, adolescents, and young adults, even folks under 25 years old. Science has told us that the brain, the decision-making process, is not fully developed. So that's one thing that I want to mention. The other thing that I would mention is this idea of the school to prison pipeline. We as a society, you know, we need to take a societal intervention on the perception and the criminalization of young Black men. There's a criminalization that's taking place literally in the schools. You know, we need to talk about the school to prison pipeline, where teachers and principals are precursors to prosecutors and judges. You know, we're literally prosecuting our young kids. My wife is a school teacher, and I have an intimate closeness to seeing this happen. She's taught both in the Ferguson School District and in Baltimore City. I take full responsibility and accountability, and I'm very remorseful, and I have a full understanding of the decisions that I was making at that time. But we also need to have a serious conversation about the surrounding factors to youths and adolescents making those decisions.
You're right. I mean, it is a hugely complicated, convoluted issue. But I'm wondering if, when you look back over your life, do you think that there was any kind of intervention or anything that could have happened when you were younger that could have prevented the path that you went on?
You know, that question sounds extremely fascinating, but I'm not sure how helpful it can really be, in that, you know, every individual experiences life very individualistically, right? So, you know, what may have worked for me is, you know, not to say that it would work for someone else. And in education, we often have this cookie cutter mold of what we need. We have Common Core and all these regulations, and it trickles down to the actual teacher who has this set idea on the futures of our youth. So for one, I don't really have an answer to your question, so I circled around it.
I figured I'd ask, because I imagine there's a lot of listeners and educators who are probably thinking about that. What could they do with young kids, and they see them headed down a path?
One thing that I could say is that we need to see value individualistically. And what I mean by that, we need to view folks as assets. You know, part of what we do in our program, we use something called this asset-based model, where we see our scholars' experiences as assets. We see value in them. From a teacher's perspective, when a kid is not meeting the norms of what is in place, and now they're this kind of outlier, or they have conduct problems, and we start to attach labels, instead of seeing those as problems, we need to see them as assets because they're different. They're a different person. We need to work with that individual kid to provide instruction that will utilize this aspect of him as a strength, not mm-hmm. viewing it as this weakness of his or this problem of his.
I'm wondering what you hear from people who come to your program, formerly incarcerated. What do you hear from them? What are they looking for?
We advertise ourselves as providing mentoring and educational counseling to help folks navigate the college process, both application, loans, scholarships, and then also the actual college experience. So that sounds very much like programs for first-generation college students, right, that need extra mentors and need extra support and extra tutors. But in actuality, we are far more than that, and we're actually just very different from that in that we offer the environment that we've created is very much this therapeutic space where we're building community. So we're looking to increase our scholars' pro-social connections. And there's studies that have shown that if you increase someone's positive interactions and you put them in those types of environments, it's beneficial for them. What our scholars are saying is that they needed this connection. They needed this mm-hmm. community. They needed this place where they can feel valued again because they've been broken down. And aside from the actual resources, tools, materials that we deliver, we've created this environment where they can see people like myself and all of our mentors are formerly incarcerated college graduates. They can see people that they aspire to be, and they can be open about sharing their past experiences and their future aspirations in this safe space.
Navigating the path to college can be tricky for a lot of people. There's all these barriers, especially for formerly incarcerated individuals. You yourself, you said that you were rejected multiple times when you applied.
Right, right.
What are some of the ways higher education can kind of take some steps to be more welcoming to this population?
That is a topic that I am very passionate about. And I think part of it is, again, helping change the perception that society has, and also people in admissions more specifically have on people with conviction. So there's this stigma attached with incarceration and conviction. And one of the first things that we need to address is that, you know, I am not this anomaly. We're very early on in our organizational phase, but we've already helped 27 of 29 of our scholars. Many of them are pursuing PhDs, MDs, law degrees. And this is very early on. So we will hopefully connect with many more people like them already in the program. There's a lot of talent and potential that we're locking behind those walls and that we're locking in these cages. I could go into a lot of the specific barriers, such as the box, asking the criminal conviction question on applications. Studies have shown that that's a significant barrier. You know, question 23 on the FAFSA, asking about drug convictions, and if you answer a certain way, stopping people from pursuing higher education. Because when you don't fill out the FAFSA, you not only can't get federal aid, but you can't get state aid, you can't get institutional aid, you can't get aid from private organizations, because we're all relying on the FAFSA's information to say, like, this person needs money. Right. And then there's things such as the actual aspects of the application that we need to address with, you know, admissions counselors. Nitty-gritty things like most people who've been incarcerated may have difficulty getting their transcripts, may have not done standardized tests, and a lot of times there's eligibility that you can't be outside of high school more than 2 years. So there's a lot of nitty-gritty things that are creating these barriers, and admissions people who are on the ground don't even know about them.
You know, it's interesting because you were rejected in your own process applying to schools, it sounds like, several times.
So I applied to 6 programs and I got into 1.
And you knew why, right?
Yeah. The fact that I finished at the top of my class and it was the same application,
right.
You know, I would argue that I was probably good enough to get into those other institutions as well. And, you know, I had to check the box on all of those applications, even the one that I got in. But of course, I had this mentor on the back end of things advocating for me. It seems pretty clear to me that it was checking that box. You know, I have this felony conviction. Even to this day, when I see that box, it literally brings about this visceral fear within me. I have a number of different degrees behind my name. I'm, you know, a professor at two very well known institutions, and yet still, when I'm applying to different things, whether they be grants and, you know, different applications, and I see that question, it still brings me to this point that says, I'm not good enough. They will never want me. I'm just a criminal.
Well, that's really powerful. How do you find that sort of drive to keep going for it?
I have developed this network of support systems. Going back to the beginning, had I not had this mentor in my life who was pushing me, I may have not completed that application. In fact, NYU did a study and they showed that 60% of people who had convictions stopped and didn't complete the application. So we've now cut out almost 2/3 of people who could potentially be the next cure for cancer. Like, in our program, we have the first formerly incarcerated person who will step foot on Mars. No one has been to Mars, and we have somebody in the program who has that aspiration and who has that intelligence, who has that potential, who's moving to apply to be an astrophysicist at MIT. And very likely, with our support, he's on his way. There's so much potential in this population.
Dr. Stanley Andreis is an assistant professor at Howard University and Johns Hopkins University. He is also the director of From Prison Cells to PhD. I'm Jill Anderson. This concludes the fall season of the Harvard EdCast, produced by the Harvard Graduate School of Education. Thanks so much for listening, and please be sure to tune back in for the next installment of the Harvard EdCast coming at you in February 2019.